And now you have the power. Welcome to Castle Grayskull Radio with your hosts, Mega Ran and Marco. Some assembly required. Your parents helped to put it together.
In the center of the universe, on the planet Eternia, is Castle Grayskull, the ancient fortress of mystery. Its power sought by the dark forces of Snake Mountain, the sanctuary of sin and sorrow, ruled by the evil Skeletor.
Two men, Mega Ran and Marcos, have created a secret bunker deep within the dungeon of Castle Grayskull, and through secret broadcast links between worlds, have discovered a way to bring you updates from this distant universe. This is Castle Grayskull Radio, a new Masters of the Universe podcast. You have the power! Today, the power has spread, and we have a third member of our team temporarily, a special guest who has transported here into our universe, who has a lot of connection to this universe. Composer, creator, musician, so many different things, so many different titles. You know him, you love him. You absolutely know his work, and you for certain love it. And a man I'm happy to call a friend. Our special guest today is Mr. Bear McCrary. How are you, sir?
Doing great, you guys. It's fun to be here with you and chatting about one of my favorite nerdy subjects, Masters of the Universe.
Snap.
Well, good. You're in the right place. Thank you for taking the time to chat with us. When I saw your name involved in this project, I got super excited. I mean, I was already hype, but then like hype levels went over the top, you know, just knowing your work, knowing what you create and how awesome it is, and being a part of this excited me. So first of all, I just want to take the people back to how me and you met. Actually, it was like a really like weird coincidental thing. I don't know if you remember this, but like,
oh, I remember.
Yeah, we were at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
And I'm at the Capcom booth and I'm scheduled to do an interview, and I guess they got backed up. So they were like, "Well, we got to do two interviews at once." So, yeah. Guy Javeth at Capcom's like, "Well, can I just bring you on with Bear?" And I'm like, "Okay." And he's like, "You guys know each other?" I'm like, "No." And yeah. We like immediately start talking and meeting each other at the same time that we're being interviewed. Because I think at that time you had done the Dark Void soundtrack. Was that it?
Yeah. I mean, it's worth pointing out, you know, we'd each done different things for Capcom. Aside from the fact that we're both musicians in different genres, there is no reason to interview us together, but we like met on camera and it was great. Cause I remember thinking like, man, we should do more interviews together. This was awesome. You know, because like we both love the same things, and like I love Mega Man, and I loved what you were doing with it. But it was sort of funny. I think they got kind of lucky because it could have been like, why are we on stage at the same time? Like I did the orchestral score to this Dark Void game, and you're doing raps with Mega Man. Like there's no overlap, but there was, thankfully. So that was cool.
Luckily, there was. Yeah, like another person might have been like, okay. No, get me away from this. This is not what I came here for.
So you basically, you guys were like, did we just become best friends?
More or less, man. I think
more or less, like in the midst of the interview, we're like, wait, you like the stuff that I like? What? You know?
And then
it worked out really well.
You did some stuff with, I think, some of my tunes on Dark Void Zero.
Yes. We did some remixes to some of those and made some hip hop tracks out of them, and they came out really cool.
Yeah, and then I was like, oh wow, like this guy's so just like clever and cool, and yeah, man, we've collaborated several times since then, and some other stuff is on the horizon in that department, so it's cool. But yeah, it's all thanks to the guy at Capcom to pair us up.
Yeah, it just worked out. So there's a photo of that day. I feel like I've seen it a few times since then, and my wife is in the background, and this is before she was my wife. She just kind of was standing there just like, all right, I'll just hang out while you do your interview. And I always point that out because we were so young and we were just dating and hanging out. I think that was her first time coming to a con, and then we wound up getting married years later.
There you go. You know, and my not yet wife was also there, and I was just talking with her about that day this morning when I was telling her we were going to be hanging out. And you know, she said something like, you know, that's the magic of Comic-Con that I really miss. That like you meet people at Comic-Con and you make lifelong friends immediately. And I could tell, I was like, yeah, you know, you're right. You take it for granted that every summer you go to these cons. And of course, we haven't been to one in a while, and I don't know when I'm going to do one again. But I did look back on that and I go, oh yeah, that's one of those things that like when you're at a thing like Comic-Con and you meet kindred spirits, you're just immediately like click, you know? And that it definitely
absolutely
happened to me. That was cool.
So crazy, because like I met Marcos at a wrestling convention, so same thing, you know.
Well, yeah, like, and look at us now.
Yeah, man, it's like when you're at those kind of things and you know that everybody around you is passionate about the things you're passionate about, and it allows you to sort of bypass a lot of conversations and just get right into like, oh my god, tell me about Mega Man, you know, like tell me how, you know, what was your first Mega Man game. Whereas with a person on the street, like the odds that they're that into Mega Man are pretty low to begin with, you know?
Yeah. That's the cool thing about conventions, because it brings people that have common interests together. And it's kind of like it takes away, like you said, all the extra baggage of trying to filter to see what you guys already start off on a common thing. Like it's very rare that you go to a convention for something. Somebody's like, oh, no, I don't like this.
Yeah. Like, but, like somebody in a Wolverine costume being like, no, bro, that's nerdy shit. I'm not into that.
I don't read comic books. What is this crap?
It's like, this is my Tuesday outfit.
Yeah.
All right, so let's start with the first question, most important one. What is your history with Masters of the Universe? Did you watch the cartoons? Did you buy the toys? What's your relationship, if any, with it?
Definitely. Oh. Did you get the toys?
All of the above, man. Like, all of the above. I was born in 1979. So I'm in the sweet spot for growing up with Masters.
It's a perfect spot.
You know what I mean? So like really my first fictional worlds were Star Wars and Masters of the Universe. And I don't mean to compare them. I mean, Star Wars is better written and better produced. There's no question. But Masters of the Universe was in my house all the time.
Yes.
So I was going to Eternia more often than I was going to Tatooine. You know, that was like the special occasion, you know, especially as he got a little older. It's like we'd rent a VCR so we could rent Star Wars and watch it at once, you know? But man, I just felt this huge affinity for Masters of the Universe. And I watched the cartoons. They were some of my first toys. And really, like, looking back on it, it's like, wow, that was like a gateway drug into hard sci-fi and hard fantasy. You know, where it's almost like you branch out from there and it's like Aliens and Blade Runner, you know, all kind of come from this weird world where technology and magic and sort of high fantasy like Conan the Barbarian aesthetic, all that kind of Frank Frazetta stuff, it was all mashed together in this one thing. And when you see that when you're four, it's like it's a gateway into all these other things. So I always had a huge affinity for it and kind of took that with me, you know, into adulthood. I never forgot it.
So let me ask you this. At what age did you realize is the whole thing, the background of Masters of the Universe, the original one, that it was just like a way to sell toys? Like to me, like I go back and forth. Like, you know, if you read about it, its creation was. But to me, I guess I bought the toys because I'm a child. But even as an adult, like it wasn't commercialized for me. Like, you know what I mean? It was like, like I love the content. I wasn't there like, oh, this is where they were like, buy this. And you know?
I think that I didn't kind of discover that until much later. I mean, I was probably in college when I really thought about what was happening. I mean, at the same time, you know, our age, all of us here, that was inescapable. So to say that we could observe it, it's like when you realized you're walking in an ocean of air. It's like it's air. Because everything on TV, when they deregulated in the early 80s and basically said, there used to be laws against this. When they deregulated and said, you can make a cartoon that sells toys as long as there's a moral message, then it's okay. And suddenly, boom, you got G.I. Joe, Transformers, He-Man, Thundercats, Gem, all of it with a little moral at the end. But you know what I mean? So we didn't know what it was like to watch a kid's show that wasn't selling toys. Yeah, in a way, certainly. Like, it didn't matter. It wasn't a problem for me. And I also don't think that, like, I think it's easy to, like, judge it harshly now, but it's like the most successful entertainment brand right now is arguably the MCU. They're not selling action figures, but they're selling something. You know what I mean? Like, so to say that, well, the show or the movie only exists to monetize elsewhere, it's like, yeah, but that's capitalism. That's not a problem. What, in a way, you look the other way and you go, they found a way in this rigid structure to make characters that we remembered for 40 years. And that's not to say that we remember them all. I can't tell you the name of the GoBots. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? But I remember.
Psy-Kill, Leader One, and that's it.
Yeah, dude. But yeah, He-Man and Teela and Evil-Lyn and Mossman, and I remember all of them.
Yeah, those, you're definitely right there. If you think about it with the MCU, they do it strategically. Like, it's more for adult things. Like, I remember people that have vast wealth that I knew in my circle. Well, like, you know, after seeing Iron Man, like, oh, I want that Audi. And then all of a sudden you saw Audi make a resurgence because you know, Iron Man drove a spec'd out car that wasn't even available on the market yet. But because they were like, oh my God, Tony Stark drives this. Oh, I definitely want this.
So think about the equivalent of that, like how cool that was. The equivalent of that when we were kids was The Wizard with Fred Savage. Do you remember how blatant that movie was? Like, so
that's a big commercial.
They figured out ways to make it cool. So that ultimately what started off with a kid like holding up his power glove, and even as a child, I remember rolling my eyes going, come on, you know, but now, yeah, like the advertising is always part of it. It's part of big budget storytelling. The question is, can you tell a good story while you're doing that? So you can justify spending the money to make the thing, you know, and even Star Wars, I cited how sophisticated its writing was before, but obviously was not immune to that kind of merchandising either. So that was everywhere.
For sure, man. All right, I want to ask you about how making this soundtrack compared to maybe doing other things. And I'm not sure. Is this the first animated series that you've soundtracked?
It is, actually. I have never done an animated series, despite the fact that I have, not only to say I grew up on animated series is inaccurate. I still consume animated series all
as the time. As do I. Hands up for those who still do.
Yes, indeed.
Samurai Jack and She-Ra and Avatar and Korra, you know, on and on. These are great stories that resonate with me. And then, now I have a kid. I can share them with her, but I don't watch them because she wants to watch them. I watch them because I watch them.
Move over. I want to watch this.
I've always wanted.
So, how did making something for an animated series differ from TV shows, movies, things like that for you?
Well, it's funny because in a way, when I started out in television, my first show, my first job really was a show called Battlestar Galactica, which was live action. But when I thought about the kind of TV score I wanted to do, I didn't grow up like loving TV music. I started writing music because I love film music. And generally speaking, there was just more interesting things happening in film than TV.
Yes.
And so when I got a TV show, I was like, oh, I'm doing TV now. What show do I want to emulate? And I'm grasping it. And then I went, oh, it's obvious. Batman the Animated Series. That is the show, the animated or not, that is the show with the kind of score that I like. It's all orchestral. Every character has a theme. And when that character is on screen, you hear their theme. And it's lush and serious and cinematic and basically indistinguishable from its big budget feature counterpart. So, you know, that was always my way into writing series. So when I got the call on Masters, I was like, oh, well, that's how I like to approach anything to begin with. So I think that kind of as a starting point, big orchestra, themes, a big cinematic sound, you know, referencing Batman the Animated Series in ambition, though not ultimately in genre. You know, I went with a different kind of color. But that was where I started. And how is it different? I'm going to be honest with you guys. I've done a bunch of live action shows And I thought, I was like, oh man, these are 24-minute episodes. I'm used to 60-minute episodes on Outlander and streaming shows like that. So I was like, this is easy, bro. Like, no problem. Yeah, not the case. I was astonished at how difficult it was. As if 90 minutes of activity have been compressed into this 24 minutes. It was way harder than I thought. And when I finished 101, which, to be fair, starts off with a gigantic battle sequence that would normally end a show.
Yep.
When I finished that, it was 6 weeks of work. I mean, 18 hours a day. And I was like, can I do this? Is this insane? I got 9 more of these. But I stuck with it, you know? I was like, I want to do this. I want to know what an animated show sounds like if I did the score and I did what I want to hear. And I just want to get to the end and make it happen.
Nice.
That's cool. So a question that I wanted to ask, like, how hands-on was Kevin Smith, like, in the music process? Do you have any fun stories, anything? Because I know it was probably a little bit different. I don't know what scoring it might not have been because of, you know, COVID-19 and everything. Like, just share with us, you know, give us whatever you can tell us behind the curtain that is allowed. Sure.
No, I had a lot of interactions with Kevin. I mean, really, Kevin was the other draw for me, because it's one thing to say, okay, you're gonna do a new spin on He-Man, but with Kevin attached, and I of course know his all his feature work, but I also know his comics work, and I've just seen him speak, you know, and I thought, wow, this is a really smart guy to do this, and it's funny because I felt maybe. Because I'd seen him speak so many times, I felt almost like I knew him. I'd never met him. I'd never interacted with him in any way until we were on a meeting that, yes, was on Zoom. Most of our interactions have been remote just because of COVID, but that didn't change the amount of times we interacted. In fact, mm-hmm. if anything, I'm sure it meant we interacted more, because I ended up just texting and sending reaction videos with him like all night. All the time, you know what I mean? Like, my wife's ready to go to bed, and I'm like, hang on, honey, I'm chatting with Kevin Smith over here, you know what I mean? And we're just nerding out about He-Man, you know, and sending each other reaction videos. He would send me, I mean, we even posted some of them publicly, because he would just point the camera at himself, and he'd be like, all right, man, I'm listening to your stuff, and like, oh, I love this. And I'd just send back a video, and I'd just be like, yeah, just throwing the horns, you know. It's totally replicated the feeling of being in the room with him. But I get ahead of myself. That feeling clicked into place almost instantly. So I met him, and I also met Rob David from Mattel, who struck me as like a really smart, like super nerd. Like, he knows everything about the brand and also just about all the stories we were referencing. Empire Strikes Back, Lord of the Rings, Conan the Barbarian, all that kind of stuff. And normally I would say, I kind of have a shtick that I have in meetings, prospective meetings. I'm trying to win people over. And the mm-hmm. best way to win them over is to listen. Part of my job is to just be collaborative and listen. And I would always say, so what do you want to do? Tell me about your vision. Uh-huh. Okay. Tell me more. And I kind of, you know, bond with me. But partly because I just felt like, man, I feel like Kevin and I are on the same page. I thought, I'm just going to spare us all the time. And I was like, all right, guys, I don't mean to interrupt this, but here's the deal. This is what I want to do on Masters of the Universe. It should sound like Conan the Barbarian, but meets, it's like Basil Poledouris, when he scored that film, hired Metallica in 1982 to collaborate with him. I want it to sound like Heavy Metal, the Ivan Reitman film. I want it to feel like a straight fantasy, but with metal stuff. And it's totally serious. There's no winking. There's no comedy. I just want it to sound like the biggest fantasy score ever. And if any of that scares you, we should part ways right now.
And I'm assuming they were like, this is our guy. Like, well, cancel all the other meetings.
Totally, oh, yeah, man. This well, is what's it. Funny is Kevin, on a dime, he just starts, he doesn't say a word. He starts singing the theme from Conan the Barbarian. And I start singing with him. And then when we're done singing, he goes, you just said the magic words. So I was like, and then I think I looked him in the eye. There was a pause, and I go, Kevin, I'm going to have to do your show now.
That is awesome. Like, it's always good to hear the creative process. Now, speaking of, you know, you mentioned iconic projects and everything. Did you have any pressure to live up to the original? Because you've scored some amazing projects before, like Godzilla, initially, were you like, okay, I sold this, I know where I'm going. I know you mentioned that it was 18-hour days for 6 weeks, but like before you got into your mojo, into your process, were you like, okay, so how do I deliver?
Like, yeah.
It's a lot of pressure.
And a big question I would know, like, as far as comparing to the original, did you ever like put the original 83 Filmation show on mute and then play your tracks over? And I'm like, yeah.
No, did you ever try that? But I am trusting that some fan, you know, I bet you guys lunch, some fan has already done this. If we go to YouTube, I'm sure we'll see it.
I'm sure.
super cut.
I know. No, look, there's a lot of them. I always feel the pressure when I'm playing in a brand that means something to fans and means something to me. And I've done this with Battlestar, with Terminator, with Godzilla, with Child's Play. You know, I've had a lot of experience, actually. The Omen, going and tinkering with a mythology. And it's different every time. I approach it differently every time. Do you quote the old theme? Do you homage the old theme? Do you completely ignore the old theme? I've done everything across the spectrum. And oddly, this one was maybe the toughest for me, because of all the things that I have been a part of rebranding musically, not counting Star Wars. I keep forgetting. I did an Oculus game for Star Wars. So technically I've done a Star Wars thing too, which is dope. Mm-hmm. But like for Godzilla and Battlestar, I knew that stuff growing up, and Godzilla especially. But like He-Man was close to my heart, gentlemen. That's where it was like, for me, that old theme was like one of my, it was like a lullaby sung to me by my parents. It's like I grew up on that. And so I came to it, forgetting even the pressure from fans and pop culture. It was just me, like, how am I going to live up to that? Should I use it? And then change it, incorporate it. And ultimately, it was almost like my love for it that influenced me to realize I couldn't use it. I couldn't polish it. And I ended up taking more of an approach that I took on Battlestar, which was like, hey, that old thing is amazing. But similar to the old Battlestar theme, those themes from that like late 70s, early 80s had such uplift and innocence and joy and playfulness, all these qualities that we love about it. And I found that that was at odds with the story we were telling, and that the nostalgia atomic bomb of memories that was triggered. Every time you hear that, I was like, man, I kept going back to like other stuff like Willow and Fellowship of the Ring and Conan the Barbarian. And I was like, even Star Wars, I was like, that's what Motu feels like to me, even though technically it didn't sound like that at all. And I finally just kind of committed that it's like, I got to make a thing that sounds like my memories of the show. And maybe at some point in the future, like I did with Battlestar, I eventually quoted the old theme. I found a great place to quote it. But from the get-go, I kind of had to like, my methodology was like, I got to divorce and write a thing that is in line with the tone that we're telling. And ultimately, I have no regrets. I mean, the theme that I wrote is tailored to work in the way that we need it to work. And I'm proud of it, man. I think it holds up, but you know, time will tell.
I think it holds up too. Like I liked it. I jumped at the chance when Rand was like, oh, I know Bear. And I was like, dude, definitely got to get him on. Like,
so let's talk about the actual show. Is there a moment, a scene? I mean, now that it's out, I guess we can talk about it. Is there a scene somewhere in the first five episodes where you were like, whoa, okay, so I have to now tailor a piece of music to fit this scene perfectly? And yeah, is there a moment where you nailed it and you're the most proud of in the series? Can you, if you could think of one?
Oh, the tough question is, can I think of only one? Because right, what I love about the show is how many moments like that there were. On one side, there's the spectacle that I get to score Man-at-Arms charging in like a bat out of hell. You know what I mean? Just like, he's so badass.
Yeah. You know?
But the thing is, guys, like, really, I'm going to be honest with you. That was sort of like falling off a log. It's to me, I was like, oh, I got this. I know exactly what to do there. Man at Arms, like dropping to his knee and asking Teela for forgiveness. You got to do the theme that works when he's charging into battle. And it's got to work there. It's the same theme. It's the same guy. Mm-hmm. Then I was like, ooh, that adds a wrinkle. That adds a challenge. The best example of all is Orko. I don't think any character has a wider emotional range. So when we meet Orko, it's goofy, it's light, it's comedic. It's a bullseye right out of the old show.
Yep.
My memories of the old show, which I have not revisited out of design lately, my memories of the old show were like, I don't remember themes for each character, but I do remember that Orko was always accompanied by like light, plucky, comedic. Mm-hmm. Goofy. They went out of their way to be like, hey kids, laugh at this guy. That's what we did. That's what Kevin wrote. But of course, even by the end of the first episode, Orko appears and he saves Man-at-Arms, setting up this conflict between Evil Lyn, a conflict and relationship with, really. Mm-hmm. And then when we meet him in 3 and we realize that the lack of magic in Eternia is killing him, and suddenly it's like, oh my God, this is like old Yeller. This is like the cute character that we're going to have to put down, you know? And
yep.
How could I make a theme that plays goofy, then plays heroic, then plays sad, then kind of gets back up off its feet, and then plays triumphant and badass as hell. And then finally, in the beginning of 5, at the grave marker, you get this one wisp in the solo flute. And I wanted even a casual audience to recognize, oh, that's the same tune every time. It's the same thing you're hearing. I'm very literal. That was a beast, you know?
Wow.
So, moments like that, it was like, man, I got extra coffee in the morning and I spent a month. I said it took me 6 weeks to write one episode. It took me 2 months to write the themes to begin writing the first episode because I had to write them all out in advance, guys. Like Teela shows up, Evil Lyn, Adam, Man at Arms, Sorceress, Skeletor. That's all in the first 12 minutes.
Oh, yeah. God. Yeah, everybody's Beastman, there at the beginning.
Beastman and Battle Cat. I mean, really, the only character themes you get after the first one, I have like 6 or 7 in the first episode. Roboto gets a theme. Scareglow gets a theme. And there's one other character we meet in the second
Merman. Triclops Merman. And the no, motherboard.
Merman. And Triclops. Oh, yeah, Merman. Yes, of course. The mm-hmm. motherboard Triclops thing. But it seems like, aside from that, the first episode had so many themes in it that I was like, I got to do my... I almost have to write a symphony before I start.
Mm-hmm.
And so ended up, you know, it was almost a solid year. I mean, it was like 10, 11 straight months of work where it was, you know, 18-hour days most days to be able to do that. And, you know, guys, I don't know if I'm going to do another animated show. This might be it for me. I'm proud of it, but holy
yeah, right. God, this is awesome. Not it. I would be surprised that your virtual time. Door is not being knocked down for animated series after this.
Yeah. Like you did a really awesome job. So I guess, you know, to address the elephant in the room, what are your thoughts on the series? You know, are you surprised that anything surprised you when you first, I assume you had a run through the episodes before anybody. And, you know, here's the thing that, you know, I don't want people to, you know, put a black bag over you and snatch you away. Is there something that cool you could tell us about the next 5 that's not spoilery, but you won't get like snatched up, you know?
Yeah, we don't want to get you in trouble, but yeah, like, what do you think?
All right, well, here's a few things. I was as surprised as anyone when Adam sacrifices himself. Adam dies in 101. Hope, spoiler alert, I should have said that a minute ago, but
I know.
No. If somebody skipped all of our episodes and went to this one, they should have seen the show.
Yeah, exactly. Here's what I thought. You know, first of all, I was like, oh my God, you know, I was shocked. And then the scenes that followed and the episode that followed, you know, won me over very quickly. I was fascinated by the emotional fallout and it, you know what I thought of? This is going to be a weird analogy. I haven't heard anybody else make this comparison, but I thought of Superman 2, the Richard Donner / Lester, who directed it, who knows. It's a mess of a film. But here's what happened in Superman 2. they momentarily really up the stakes. Clark Kent is going to tell Lois Lane who he is. Holy shit! Nothing will ever be the same again.
Yep.
The world is different. Comics are different. It's the most daring. Oh, he erased her memory. The end. Like, even as a kid, I was like, and then they start Superman 3, which is hilarious. But it's like, are we really not going to? Lois Lane just doesn't remember.
It is like, dude.
So to anyone that wants that kind of storytelling, the old show exists for you. If you want or episodes that can be reordered, that isn't the kind of storytelling that anyone is making anymore. I think serial long form storytelling is better for audiences. It's better for storytellers. And, you know, to do something like that on Masters of the Universe, which was very much like any other show from that era, you could watch the episodes in any order. They always reset at the end. The stakes could only go so high. I was thrilled, man. And then I was thrilled that these writers, within this very limited 24-minute real estate, they made me feel for Orko. They made me feel for Roboto. When that guy is fading away and he says, no, this is great. I feel fear. I was like, this is some Blade Runner shit. This is like hard sci-fi. I scored a Terminator show in like, we did 32 or 40 episodes, something like that. That is the kind of idea, the kind of emotion that like goes in a show like that. And these guys in Roboto had like four scenes. You know what I mean? And they did it. I mean, it was masterful.
Yeah,
they did. So what can I say about the back five is that I think that they're going to build on this. And I think fans are going to be really happy. I think fans have seen half a show. And I think that I can easily say, the back five are superior to the first five. You've watched the tee up. I mean, it's all just build up. You know what I mean? Like the back five are where things really go down. And
I keep telling people this is like, you can't, it's like you judging a meal when you just had the appetizer course. Is
totally.
Like,
totally.
Like you, like, and, you know,
yeah.
And it was a good appetizer. I loved the five episodes. And I do understand what you mean, you know, using the Superman 2 analogy, it's like they did it in a wonky way and they did it in an unbelievable way on top of that. And then it's like, you got to understand, it's like I equated to like, you guys remember Married with Children?
Sure.
That every time they had a get rich scheme, it's like, it doesn't matter what it was. You knew that the next episode they were going to be broke. So, yeah. Because that's the premise of the show, because it's short form storytelling. So I am super excited. I can't wait to see the back five. I know Ran is, man, I'm thank hyped. You.
We talk about a lot on the show how like this series, it flips the original kind of on its head in that way where there isn't that wrap up at the end of the 30 minutes, everyone laughing together, ho ho ho, credits, you know, and it's not very light, you know, and and immediately it gets very heavy.
Well, let me ask you guys, what surprised you? What were the moments that stood out to you?
I honestly, when I was watching it, I watched the episodes before Ran. Because Ran was a little bit busy, and the first episode, I was like, okay, now, like, you know, like, you ever been playing video games, the meme is like, you're sitting back, but then when you get serious, you kind of lean in. That's basically what I did. I was like, okay, you got my attention, and then I stopped everything that I was doing, and I was like, now I watch and dissect, and I was like, wow, this show was a beast, and I'm looking forward. Like, even where it ended, I was like, oh!
Yeah, the ending, I was mind blown. Like, I was falling off my seat.
Like, if you would have given me, like, 3 more minutes, I would have still been probably even more like, oh, I get why?
Yeah, and that was one of those moments that for me. Just, if I had to pick my favorite moment, I think it was that. I think I called Kevin after I sketched it. I might have even been crying because I was like, Kevin, there are a few moments in my career, narrative scenes that I look back on that I go, man, I got to write music for that. And that ending of 105 is one of those moments. Like, I just know I'm going to remember this the rest of my life. I got to do that.
Yeah, that is awesome. And a small thing, and me and Rand talked about it in the previous episodes, is that finally we get two individuals to use their weapons in the way that you thought that these weapons were designed.
Yeah.
People like, get stabbed, you know, like we didn't see that ever.
It's like G.I. Joe, everybody shooting, nobody even went to a medic. It wasn't like, I got winged.
Nobody got clipped. But here, they used them.
And it was also so clever because it preserves the continuity of everything we grew up with. Because it shows, like, it's not just like now there's violence in the show. It actually was triggered because Skeletor has a plan that necessitates violence in order to make it happen. He needs to trick He-Man into using the sword. And then he thinks the way to do that is to lure Mossman out and murder him. And even though we've had all these adventures where nobody got hurt, now you can imagine Skeletor being like, yeah, but I need what I want. So I'm going to do that. Yep. Now. So it's crazy. That's what I love about the show is that it's not a dark, gritty reboot. It's just, it's like you get to see these characters. You get to see what I never got to see with Superman. What happens after Lois Lane goes, okay, wait a minute. You lied to me? And wait, how does this work? And like, wait, there's so many things I want to know. And then, you know what I mean? Like all that sort of blowback that would happen in the realm of Superman. So I was really impressed with the writing. And what's great about the back half is that it is less episodic. I saw one review that was like, oh, the show preserves the same thing where they go on an adventure each week. And I'm like, no, it doesn't. This is a movie. No. You know what I mean? Just like it's sort of like, okay, well, we're going to Dagobah, we go to Hoth, but it's not an episodic story, you know, because the character arcs across Empire Strikes Back are it's one thing. That's what's happening here. It only looks episodic because we happen to have two episodes that each have their own location in Subterranean and Returnee. But you know what I'm saying? Yeah. That's how, when you make up your mind based on five episodes, I completely understand why it looks that way. But I'm very excited to see what happens when people see all 10, because that's how we approached it. It was like one big big 5-hour movie.
Nice. I honestly, you know, and again, not knowing what happens in the back five, like, I hope this is something that gets renewed or we see more content, because that's the number one thing is about me. Like, Rand always asked me, like, what do you like about these shows and these shows that you watch? I was like, well, here's the thing. As an individual, as you said, this show is 40 years old. I'm a person that, I know at some point somebody's going to look at an IP and be like, we can't make no more money off of this or something like that. I'm like, I always love content. If content is being brought with some passion that is not just a quick cash grab, I'm always for it, because you never know when you're going to see it. Like, case in point, the previous version that is kind of like the Dragon Ball Z GT version of the show, which was the 2002 version that they made. It's like it was canon, and it's like, nah, it's not canon. Like, that show was really good. And then somebody with a stroke of a pen was like, you know what? We're going to leave this story incomplete because we don't want to do this no more.
And you know what's crazy is that it took 20 years to make that show, and then 20 more years to make this one.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to even be able to use the proper technology at 60 something
to watch the next version.
The next version.
2041.
Yeah, it's also like being able to share what we grew up with in a meaningful way. Like the analogy would be for my parents, like they grew up on Howdy Doody. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And like stuff like that. And I look at it and it's like, even when I was a kid, I was like, that's stupid. You know, I mean, Toy Story was sort of making fun of the kid shows from the 50s. You know what I mean? And like, in a weird way, it's so awesome that for me, not only are they making a Masters of the Universe that I still like, and it's like, yes, thank you. But also my 7-year-old daughter, who I showed the episodes to, every time I finished one, I got the demos together. I showed them to Kevin. I was like, all right. Gather my wife and kid. I go, what do you guys think? You know, my daughter is entranced. I mean, she loves this show. And I was like, wow, like, thank you, Mattel and Netflix. Because now I can share this. It's not Howdy Doody. It's like, in a weird way, like, I'm really enjoying this, but like, my daughter's going to potentially remember Masters of the Universe when she's 40 because of this version, you know, which keeps it alive for everybody. And I think Star Wars and Marvel have seen the value in that, you know, like kind of cross-generational appeal. So to like, you know, to put it the other way, that it's like cross-generational appeal is part of the metric here. Yep. So when one very specific demographic sees a few episodes and I mean, guys, before they saw a few episodes, they decided it wasn't for them.
Oh, my God.
You know what I mean?
Oh
so it's like there's this gatekeeping that I find very frustrating.
You hit it right on you know the I mean? Head. On...
Like, you've decided that no one else can have this He-Man because you have decided that there's not enough of something in it. And the amount of spite that I see online, that it's like the energy that it takes to like shit all over Kevin and me and everybody when it's like, we're obviously super passionate about this. Like spoiler alert, I didn't get paid enough to work on this for 10 months, 18 hours a day. It's a cartoon budget, guys. This is not King of the Monsters.
Right, budget. Right.
I did it because I love it.
There's passion in here. And like, I don't see how people can't see that. But the other thing is, They're not listening correctly or not watching correctly because
the irony is right that it's like, I think if they give the show a chance, they will like it. It's like, there's a long game here. There's a long plan for stories. And what we're watching is the shakeup at the beginning. It sort of reminds me almost like, it's like everyone knows that the end of Empire Strikes Back is one of the best moments in cinema history. But can you imagine if instead, I mean, and who knows, maybe people at the time did just get super angry that Han Solo, you can't do that to Han Solo, and then spent years just complaining, I'll never watch Star Wars again, when it's like, that was awesome. And you know what I mean?
It was part two of a trilogy, like relax.
Here's the thing that I always, when I discuss in other podcasts or whatever, or even with my friends, and me and Rand talk about this with wrestling, is that people have like this view of how they remember things, and then they put a fan glass over that, and then on top of that, when they hear a reboot, they put a negative glass over that. So they have like three or four filters that the content has to go through. It's like you know, like a story, like if you talk about, like for you guys that are married, like, oh, when I met my wife, you know, this is what happened, and then your wife turns to you, was like, no, that's completely wrong. This is what happened. You were not as suave as you said. You were stuttering, and you were like, that's not how I remember. You're destroying the memory. It is like, no, you put these fan goggles and these nostalgia goggles and don't know how to let go. Like, stories progress. Imagine if comic books just rehash the same story exact verbatim. The same thing happens with animated movies that come from comics. Like, I have friends of mine that have a lens that, if they're not seeing page for page exactly how it was drawn up, they're like, this wasn't a direct adaptation. It was like, you know what? If you wanted that, just go back to the source material and read
the
that.
Old one. Like, you know what's weird, all dude? The old episodes are free on, I think it's what? He-Man. There's a He-Man YouTube site right now where you can watch every episode.
Yeah, they're not hard to find.
Get on Netflix and enjoy the new series. And right now, the soundtrack is available everywhere, streaming, download it, go get it. I've been bumping it all morning on Spotify.
Same here.
Any chance of vinyl or anything cool like that? Because I know that this fan base would love that.
I can say that there is a CD release that comes out today as of us recording this.
Nice.
Not today. And there is, I believe, a plan in the works to make autographed ones available. I'm pushing for that. And as for the vinyl release, I can't say anything, but that is my answer right now.
wait, is it?
Okay.
There's a couple guys with suits behind you. You can't really see them.
They're right on the other side of the laptop. They're going like this. Yes. So I am definitely not saying anything right now.
Gotcha.
Right. I did not hear a thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, go get the soundtrack, go watch the show, and listen to our episodes, subscribe, thumbs up them, and all those things. Thank you, Bear, for your time.
Hey, thanks for letting me join you guys. This is awesome.
Another great episode. Hopefully you enjoyed of Castle Grayskull Radio. Let the people know, Bear, how to find you on the internet.
Well, check me out on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and YouTube, Bear McCreary, or go to my website and you can see a blog entry about Masters of the Universe where I break down all the different themes and my adventures working with Kevin and everybody. So pretty much anything you want to know is out there.
Sweet. All right. Well, we're out of here like Orko. Oh. sorry, too soon, maybe.
Too soon.
All right, y'all, follow us on Twitter, Instagram. I'm at Megarand. Marcos is the Sunset Kid 56. Our music is by Game Villain and David Renda. Voiceover work by Will Strauss. Artwork by Evan Johnston. And if you got a question, just tweet it out into the world. Hashtag Castle Grayskull Pod. And now you have the power. We're out of here.
Peace.
Later.